when we take larger-than-life figures from our popular culture, we think that they're different. And they are in a way that, like the Greek gods, they're writ large. But these are all lessons for all of us. If you magnify Ernest Hemingway, as he did himself, as the culture did, as we do in studying him, we begin to realize that his great gift, besides the extraordinary literature that he put out, is his ability to remind us that we have all of these flaws. Maybe not as glaring, maybe not as great, but, you know, this is a man who loved falling in love. But the first time he fell in love, he was thrown over. He was betrayed. He was got a Dear Ernest letter that was devastating.
That's the great documentary filmmaker Ken Burns talking about the subject of his latest three-part series on PBS, Ernest Hemingway. It's a really, really great series. It's you can see it everywhere. It's not just on PBS. And the conversation with him goes into such great detail about what he learned and discovered in writing and making the film about Hemingway. He really wanted to talk about Hemingway. I thought we were going to talk about me a little bit, but apparently Hemingway is a bigger deal. Well, anyway, all right, what are you going to do? Now, it's a really, really great series if you haven't seen it. And enjoy this conversation with Ken. He really gives you sort of some great background and sort of insider insight into what he learned about Hemingway and how he came to have a different view of him after working on the project. My guest, the returning guest, Academy Award-winning filmmaker for such great works as The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, country music, the Roosevelts, Brooklyn Bridge, amazing documentary filmmaker who has a new documentary out. It's directed with Lynn Novick. It's a three-part, six-hour documentary series on the iconic literary figure, Ernest Hemingway. It's Ken Burns. Great to have you back on the show, Ken.
It's great to be with you, Paul. I do have to amend your generous introduction. I have a couple of Academy Award nominations, but I don't have the actual Oscar statue in hand. I do have a few Emmys, but I didn't want to gild my resume at all.
Well, I don't like being corrected on my own show. So for purposes of this interview, you have won the awards, my friends. I'm such a big fan that I just automatically gave you the award. Sorry about that. So I always love your work, because not just the work itself, but I always, it's like Christmas for me with you, and like what the present is. Like, I'm always wondering, like, what is he working on next? And you never cease to amaze me or surprise me in a good way. And it so makes sense that you're doing Hemingway from the vantage point that you've chosen. And I wanted to jump in and talk about like that, you know, his young life, and it's Lynn, your co-collaborator on this, who said something interesting. She said, it was wonderful to discover Hemingway young before he became that stereotype or iconic figure. And then how difficult it became as he got older and trying to live up to the image he created. How did that young Hemingway affect you in terms of how you viewed him before you started on this project and what you came away with?
You know, I can't really remember the kind of conventional wisdom, the baggage I had. I can remember the experiences as a kid of reading, you know, this short story or that novel or whatever. But, you know, and I had the outlines of his life. But of course, that mythology, that toxic masculine mythology of the, you know, the naturalist, the big game hunter, the deep sea fisherman, the brawler, the drinker, the man about town, all kind of clogged up all the arteries and made it impossible. So as you begin to dive into the project, you're in the biography business. So it's basically, and then, and then, and then. And so he's born in 1899 on July 1st, and you understand his family, which is at first blush is a comfortable middle-class family. A father's a doctor, the mother teaches art and music, and there's six kids. And there's a kind of idyllic, they're in a wealthy suburb of Chicago, Oak Park, but they vacation at their Windermere on Lake Walloon in upper, lower Michigan. And it seems idyllic. And then stuff begins to happen. There's father suffers from mental illness. There's mental illness running through the whole family. His mother is sort of outsized and selfish, narcissistic, and over-dramatizing, as our writer Jeffrey Ward put it. he's experiencing nature and art from his mother and nature from his dad, but his dad's taking him on these horrific, you know, house calls where people are dying, pregnant women are dying and babies aren't being saved and mothers aren't being saved. It's just, it's amazing. And so you begin to see all of this happening. He has a brief stint as a cub reporter at the Kansas City Star and then goes off as an ambulance driver in World War One and is nearly killed. He's blown up. He's got a 225 pieces of shrapnel in him. He's got, obviously, at 18 years old, that's PTSD. He already knows he wants to be a writer, and he comes back and he begins with the adulation that comes from the local populace to begin to sort of embellish his story. And he writes about it free. I mean, he's so good at sort of puncturing his own pretensions in life. He begins to understand that it was sort of expected for him to lie. And as he lied, he got deeper into some sort of psychological quicksand. He also begins to have concussions, 9 of which we count, all of which are kind of CTE worthy, you know, big head traumas that could cause later on dementia and depression and suicidal stuff. His father does commit suicide. Other people in the family, half of this nuclear family of 8 people, will take their own lives by the time it's over. So all of a sudden, just as you're beginning to set the table for the later success as a short story writer and then a novelist and then a nonfiction writer, you begin to see that all of the themes and the motifs are there. His mother dressed him and his sisters in girls' clothes and then in boys' clothes. And this twinning, which was not uncommon in the Victorian era, perhaps ignites in him a lifelong interest in what we would call today gender fluidity. So here's this hyper-masculine guy who wants his wives, his 4 wives, to cut their hair short and to be the boy, and he'll be the girl. And it's so fascinating, and so many of the themes of his stories and books have to do with women that are pregnant, women that are having cesarean sections, people that are dying in on the operating table. It is this fascination with death, with war, with nature itself, the redeeming, restorative parts of nature that help him and his characters, and also human nature. He's a great student of how men and women get along and how they don't get along. Mm. And he's even able to put himself in several noteworthy stories into the woman's point of view, despite the fact that both the men in these stories are exhibiting the kind of macho bravado that he did his whole life. And it's so interesting that he could do that. So we feel that once we could listen, you know, read the letters, see the manuscripts, talk to the critics, talk to other writers, understand the art, we mastered the biography by getting beyond the mythology. And there we find someone who is sensitive, someone who is anxious, someone who is empathetic to other people, vulnerable. And that doesn't seem like your garden variety, superficial idea of the macho Ernest Hemingway who bets that no one can go around with him, in the boxing ring.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, you do say in a conversation about this elsewhere that there was a pleasure in learning about how much he was struggling every day to maintain his writing discipline and to touch those moments common to all of us that are universal, wrestling with a set of demons and problems that ultimately begin to betray the mask of the He-Man he built for himself. And that really comes through in this and watching it. And I do think that you do feel like, oh my God, it's Ernest Hemingway. He is in ways like me. He has insecurities and doubts and struggling, and you're taken aback by that.
Yeah, Paul, that's exactly it. That is so astute, because when we take larger than life figures from our popular culture, we think that they're different. And they are, in a way that, like the Greek gods, they're writ large. Mm. But these are all lessons for all of us. If you magnify Ernest Hemingway, as he did himself, as the culture did, as we do in studying him, we begin to realize that his great gift, besides the extraordinary literature that he put out, is his ability to remind us that we have all of these flaws, maybe not as glaring, maybe not as great. But, you know, this is a man who loved falling in love. But the first time he fell in love, he was thrown over. He was betrayed. He was got a Dear Ernest letter that was devastating. And so he falls into these love affairs and marries these women. And then he begins to worry and begins to be anxious and begins to sabotage. This is something everyone on earth is familiar with. And all of a sudden he's moving on to somebody else because it's easier. It's more expedient. And these are horrible things to say and more important, horrible things to do as a human being. And all of a sudden he's in wife two, or he's in wife three or wife four. But it's all interesting that he falls in love wholeheartedly. And then through the writer's interest in new material or through this anxiety I'm suggesting, there's a sabotage that takes place. And so I think that in all of these glaring flaws, we can see our own, perhaps smaller ones, writ out in front of us. I mean, this is what the nature of heroism. We live in a world right now which is so binary that we lament that we don't have any heroes because we expect falsely that heroes are perfect. But the Greeks invented heroes because they wanted to deal with a person's very obvious strengths and their weaknesses. And it is the negotiation or even the war between those strengths and weaknesses that define heroism. And these could be big, larger-than-life examples for everybody else to be aware of, to be influenced by, to be better as a result. I mean, Achilles had his heel and his hubris to go along with his great strengths. And so with Ernest Hemingway, you have a kind of god, don't you, with all of these unbelievable gifts, but who is in another aspect of his life, squandering them and destroying himself because of the demons, the mental illness that existed in his family, the PTSD from World War I, the drinking, the concussions, whatever it might be. I'm not a pathologist. I didn't perform the autopsy, but one of those demons got him, or maybe all of them, a combination. And the story of it is as classic a tragedy in the midst of unbelievably brilliant output that you could ever imagine. So what? How could you not be drawn to that and want to know? And if you spend the time, as we did, then you've got the opportunity to dig really deep.
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that as brilliant a writer as he was, if I asked him right now, describe yourself to me, who are you? I don't know that he could. Like, I got this. That's what I took away from this, and as well as other things that I've read and seen about him, that he was so conflicted. And I know that feeling. You know, I mean, myself, I worked on Wall Street and left to go into entertainment and act and do comedy. But I'm incredibly insecure. And I always say, if my mother hugged me two more times, I probably wouldn't be a performer. But you know, it's sort of like there was a there's this He-Man sort of mask that he created for himself. Why do you think he created that mask? Was he struggling with his own sexuality behind the scenes?
I don't think it's struggling with sexuality. I do think he has this gender curiosity, this non-binary aspect to himself, which is interesting. I think the real worry comes from, you know, he's got a complicated mom. He's got a depressed dad who will eventually kill himself. His mom is overdramatic. She gives him his love of music. His father gives him his love of nature and fishing and hunting. And so he adopts all the things he likes to do. I mean, he is legitimately a deep sea fisherman and a big game hunter and a trout fisherman and an observer of nature. But hiding behind it, as in all of us, I don't think your revelations about yourself sound too different than anybody's revelations, that there's always a yes, but there's always a worry. There's always a gnawing thing. And for someone of these outside talents, like an Ernest Hemingway, I think that those worries get magnified as well. And so they get played out. So you construct the mythology. It's easier to say, I am all of these big, huge, brawling things, rather than admit the vulnerability. What I developed, and I never saw it coming, was a compassion for him. Like, if you suspend the judgment, the need to say nope, to cancel him, so to speak, to use today's terms, right? If you can tolerate the undertow and the complexity of this person, those inherent contradictions, not forgiving him, not holding his feet to the fire. He did reprehensible things. They're still reprehensible. He wrote bad things. They're still bad. But to also carry with him all of those things, but just as you would hope the people closest in your life would be mindful of your issues, right? Yeah. As I hope in my life, people are mindful of mine. Then you get closer to what is a big theme. You know, everyone says it's about death, and it is. You know, he's an existential writer in a way, and that, like a Tolstoy, who's, you know, arguably the greatest writer of all time, his are across generations with cast of characters and huge character development. Hemingway's, it lasts in a moment, you know? Mm-hmm. It's Indian camp and the little boy having witnessed the horrors of a cesarean section by penknife and fishing line as suture, is questioning his dad and then stops and thinks, I don't think I'll ever die. Of course, he knows, of course, he's going to die, but he felt in that moment. And what Hemingway is saying, the past is catching up to us. The future is the source of anxiety. There is only one place to be, which is right now. I mean, even one of his famous stories, The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber. This is a guy who finally is called a coward earlier on in the very short story and stands his ground to a charging animal. And he has a momentary flash of peace and courage before his wife, who despises him, blows his brains out. So The Short Happy Life of McComber is a nanosecond long.
Right.
I mean, he is about focusing on the moment. But I think if we think it's all about death, it is an underlying theme of his, but it's also about love.
Yes.
I don't mean just romantic. I just think the compassion that we can exhibit towards one another. His statements about war in A Farewell to Arms are among the finest writing ever written about all the posturing, all the sentimentality, all the BS that we, you know, talk about the glories of war and all of this stuff and sacrifice and that. And, you know, he understood it. He said it just like the stockyards at Chicago, if the only thing you did was bury the meat. I mean,
unbelievable. Yeah.
There's sort of this constant human need to go and sacrifice your own people and kill other people for no reason, no reason whatsoever.
Exactly.
And this will be around if we haven't blown up our planet 1,000 years from now.
Yeah, that's true. It's such a tremendous body of work that you've done on him. It's a three-part, six-hour documentary on Hemingway. It's airing on PBS now. It is so great to have you on. Good luck with the show, and we will talk to you again soon. Ken Burns, everybody.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Paul.
All right, that was Ken Burns. It's a great series. Check it out if you haven't. It's playing everywhere. And thank you for checking out the show. We'll be bringing another great guest next week. And also tell your friends about the podcast. Ask them to subscribe and check out the YouTube channel. Got some fun stuff there. And hope to see you guys out on the road soon when I start doing stand-up again. But see you next week.